On today's episode of Locked Up with History, we're going to be looking at some of the murders that have occurred in Victoria over the Christmas season. What is it about the Christmas season that makes some people anything but festive? Stay tuned to find out.
Warning. This podcast contains discussions of some potentially distressing topics. Listeners, please be advised. Come with us for true and tall tales unsurpassed, with stories from Victoria's dark colonial past. Spirits, executions, ghosts, murders and ghouls. These are the stories they don't teach you at school. All these twisted tales of mystique and mystery coming to you now on Locked Up With History.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Locked Up With History, Season 1, Episode 14 and our Christmas special. My name is Deb Robinson and on today's episode we'll be looking at several murders that have occurred during the Christmas period. What is it about the Christmas season that drives some people to cross that line and take someone else's life? After a very quick look through the newspapers of the day, I found at least 16 murders and two attempted murders that have occurred during the weeks around Christmas between 1857 and 1949 here in Victoria. Although I am sure there have been many, many more both here in Australia and overseas. There are cases of husbands murdering wives, perhaps, expectedly, with stresses of Christmas, but we also have a father and son, mothers and infants, brothers, workmates, the murder of a police officer, and some people who were not really known to each other. But let's delve into some of these stories, starting back in 1857. Our first few stories relate to people who were friends of some description, or in a couple of cases, complete strangers. Our first story takes place in the Myamaya Creek near Newstead, just near Castle, Maine. The body of a man was found in a waterhole in early January 1858. James Thompson had been gathering some water about a quarter mile from the Newstead Hotel when he noticed something in the water. Together with another man, they brought the bag to the shore and as they did so realised it was human remains. The body was badly decomposed and almost skeletal with a bag tied around the neck. The head detached from the rest of the body as it was brought ashore. There was a small piece of skin remaining on the left side of the face with some whiskers and moustache still attached. The cause of death was evident, with six wounds to the back of the skull, which was later identified at post-mortem as being a digger's driving pick. There were also stones loaded into the sack to aid with keeping the body from view. It was determined the cause of death of the unidentified man was murder by person or persons unknown. It would be 12 years before the man would be identified, along with his murderer. In January 1870, George Dyer entered the Bow Street Police Station in London and spoke to Inspector Hubbard, where he confessed to the murder of George Wilson at Newstead at Christmas time in 1857. Dyer confessed that the pair had been working the diggings together in late 1857 when an altercation occurred over the amount of gold realised. Dyer drew a knife and Wilson died almost instantly. He dragged the body to a nearby waterhole and weighed it down. The next day, when asked where Wilson had gone, Dyer said he had moved on to paths unknown, probably the Inglewood diggings. Dyer was extradited to Victoria to stand trial at Castlemaine. There was a process with a warrant needing to be issued before Sergeant Robert Holmes could bring Dyer back to Australia. The trial eventually took place in April 1871, where George Dyer was found guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to 8 years on the road.
You're listening to Locked Up With History.
For our next story, we head to December 15, 1925, and the Melbourne suburb of St Kilda. Here, at 11 p.m, 65-year-old Henry Tack approached the door where Rachel and Frederick Carroll and their daughter were living, along with Clara Croker and her two children. Rachel answered his knock and an argument ensued. Frederick was woken and came out to tell Tack to go about his business and not to worry his wife at this time of night. The argument continued and became heated, and eventually Tack pulled a revolver out and fired several shots. The first two directly at Rachel, who was fatally wounded. One bullet went over Frederick's head, and another narrowly missed a young woman in a neighbouring property. Rachel stumbled back down the passageway before collapsing and dying. Tack calmly walked away and disappeared down a street heading towards the beach. Now, Henry Tack and Rachel Currell were known to each other. Henry had once been a glass importer and was financially well off, with an office in York House in Melbourne. Rachel had previously worked for Henry and stated that he had given Rachel money for an operation, paid for her hospital fees, and an expensive stay in Daylesford to recover. On top of that, he had purchased her clothing, paid money towards her household expenses, which he increased when Frederick had lost his job. After the murder, Tack caught the Hygeia steamer to Sorrento and remained hidden in the tea tree bush near the beach. Henry intended to take his own life, but instead attended a local cafe for food, and it was here he was identified from his picture in the newspapers and finally arrested on Christmas Eve. At trial, he was found guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. Originally jailed at Pentridge, Henry threw himself from the first floor galley to the stone floor below, fracturing his ankle in April 1927. He was transferred to the Geelong jail for his recovery, but it was not to be. Although the splint was removed in May and he was walking in June, Henry malingered at every opportunity. He would drag himself along the floor of the hospital, creating large sores on his body. Eventually, at the end of August, he began to refuse to take food. Henry Tack died in the Geelong Jail Hospital on September 8, 1927, of blood poisoning and heart disease. Our next story takes place on Christmas Eve, 1925. Two plainclothes constables, Shankly and Whitehead, were walking along Victoria Street in North Melbourne when off-duty constable James Clare joined them, and the trio continued on towards Whitehead's home. Opposite St Mary's Cathedral and near the Victoria Market, the police encountered a group of about 20 Italians. The Italians were standing in small groups, arguing amongst themselves and jostling each other. One of them bumped Clare, and when he warned the man to behave, the man punched him in the face, knocking him to the ground. The man and his companions continued striking Clare as he was on the ground. Clare threw off his assailants and jumped up again quickly, but was attacked from behind and fell down again. As the other policemen were coming to Clare's aid, they saw two men leaving over Clare, who was resisting strongly. One man noticed the police coming and ran off, but the other man grabbed something from his pocket, then his arm rose and fell. Clare called out, "He has stabbed me." The constables pursued the assailant and each fired a shot, and the man eventually stopped and was arrested and locked up. His name was Domino Condello, a 33-year-old quarryman. A search of a piece of land near St Mary's Church, where Condello had been witnessed to stop, revealed a blood-stained clasp knife. By the time that James Clare was taken to the Melbourne hospital, he was dead. Domino Condello had stabbed him in the heart. James Clare had only been in the force for a month, although he'd been a special constable during the police strike of 1923, but he had no relatives here in Australia. He was buried with police honours, with mounted troopers, the police band, and over 400 officers in attendance. At trial, Condello was found not guilty, as the jury believed that Condello acted in the belief that during the struggle in which the constable was wounded, that his own life was in danger. For our next story, we go to Christmas night, 1949, where the mutilated body of William Stewart was discovered in a room at Gordon House, a Melbourne lodging house in Little Bourke Street. Stewart was found laying on the floor of the room, partially dressed, with his face buried in a blanket. There was a cut made with a sharp instrument down the midline of the body from the neck to the thighs and again right across the body. There were also bruises and abrasions on the face and marks on the back of the neck, probably caused by thumbnails. Police arrested the man who found the body, a city boiler attendant named Olive Carlson. He also went by the name of Frederick Seymour. It was his room in which the body had been found. Carlson stated that he had known Stewart for about 3 years and that they had met at a city hotel on Christmas Eve. Later, he saw Stewart sleeping on an allotment and took him to his room where Stewart slept that night because he was too drunk to go to his own dormitory. On Christmas Day, the two men continued to drink wine and beer in the room before Carlson said he left for South Melbourne. He stated he found Stewart's body on the floor on his return at around 8:30 p.m. The post-mortem on 60-year-old Stewart revealed that he had died of asphyxia. The pathologist also mentioned that some indecencies had taken place before Stewart had died. But we'll leave that one to your imagination. Thankfully, the man was unconscious or dead before Carlson started to dismember the body. Carlson stated that he had panicked when he tripped over Stewart's body and thought the only way to remove it was to cut it into pieces. But once he'd started to cut him up with the table knife, he became frightened and was unable to finish. Carlson was found not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter. He was sentenced to just 4 years imprisonment. Justice Duffy stated that if the full facts of the case were available to the court, that it would have been necessary to shut Carlson up for the rest of his life, for his own protection from the community. Carlson declared, after the passing of his sentence, that within 3 months of his release, he would prove to the courts and the public that he was innocent. He was never heard of again.
If you'd like to visit some of the places featured on Locked Up With History, book in a tour with Twisted History. For the full range of tours and to book, visit twistedhistory.net.au.
As expected at Christmas time, there is a rise in domestic and family violence, and more often than not associated with an increase in alcohol for the festive season. There are some things that just never change. Our next few stories will look at some of these. On Boxing Day in 1857, George Robinson murdered Margaret Brown, the woman with whom he cohabitated with near Maryborough. The pair were well known for their drinking escapades and had been drinking heavily in the week leading up to Margaret's death. They sobered up enough to socialise with others in a nearby tent, but a quarrel between the pair ensued and they left. Shortly afterwards, George was observed holding Margaret by the ankles over a 60-foot mine shaft. He soon let her go and she plunged to her death. Witnesses quickly tied Robinson up and fetched a windlass, but Margaret was dead by the time they brought her to the surface. At the inquest, it would come to light that George and Margaret had quarrelled a lot in recent weeks, and Margaret had frequently complained of the treatment she received at his hands. George would state that in passion he had given Margaret a shove as they continued to quarrel, and that he had attempted to grab her as she fell down the shaft but could not hold her. They were both very drunk. The courts would find that George Robinson was guilty of the murder of Margaret Brown, and he was executed for his crime at the Melbourne Jail on the 17th of March, 1858. Now, the tragedy of husbands murdering wives at Christmas time was not quite as common as I thought it might have been. However, this case from Christmas night 1888 is one such case. This is the story of John Anglin and his long-suffering wife Jemima, who was killed at Camberwell. John and Jemima had married at Alexandra in 1879, and the couple went on to have two children. John was 40 years old at the time of the murder and had formerly been a police constable, a member of the excise department, and then the water department. He seemed to have been moved continually due to misconduct. The marriage for the first couple of years appears to have been a happy one, but soon was marred by the insane jealousy that John had. Anglin had constantly accused his wife of adultery, accusing her of being inappropriate with her doctors, attracting the attention of the reverend in the pulpit at church, choosing hymns for the choir to attract particular gentlemen, coughing to attract the attentions of male boarders in other rooms, and refusing to allow her to buy fruit and vegetables from the Chinese because of supposed improprieties with them. John had a violent temper, and it was so bad that Jemima was forced to bring it before the courts, where John was bound over to keep the peace. For the 2 years previous to the murder, Jemima had lived with her sister and earned her own living as a music teacher in Alexandra. At Christmas time in 1888, Jemima and the children had gone to her brother's house in Camberwell to join the roads for the festive season, as had become tradition. John, learning that his wife was visiting, had made several attempts to see his wife and children, which were refused by Jemima. On Christmas Day, John had come to the house at least three times asking to see his children. The last time was around 8:30 p.m, where he demanded to see his children. Mrs. Rhodes answered the door and denied him and ordered him off the premises. At the same time, Herbert Rhodes had gone to the woodpile with the object of picking up a piece of wood to frighten Anglin off. Instead, he picked up the wood axe. Rhodes made his way towards the front door with the axe, while Anglin took out a revolver and fired, with the bullet entering Rhodes' left arm and breaking it. He made his way around the side of the house and collapsed. Anglin then made his way to the dining room, where Jemima was just coming out of the doorway. Anglin fired at her, followed her back into the dining room, where more shots were heard to be fired. Anglin then left the house and threw the revolver away before giving himself up at the local police station at Hawthorne. Jemima was found dead, with a bullet wound in her left breast and her right temple. John Anglin would stand trial for the murder of his wife and was convicted of willful murder and sentenced to death. Luckily for him, it was commuted to life imprisonment, where he was released in 1905. The two children went to live with their uncle and aunt in Camberwell. Our next story takes place in Clifton Hill on Boxing Night 1897. Michael Cregan was 69 years old and was living with his son Daniel and his wife in O'Grady Street, Clifton Hill. Daniel and his family had gone away for Christmas to visit his wife and his wife's family at Whittlesea. Another son, James, had been calling in to check on his father and did so on Boxing Night. Father and son went out for a drive together, returning home around 9 p.m, where both men imbibed in some whiskey. As the drinking continued, Michael began saying some things about his late wife and James's mother, to which James took great offence. A quarrel broke out between the two men, which eventually led to blows being exchanged. James eventually landed a blow that took the older man to the ground. At this point, James walked out and went to bed, leaving his father on the floor in the passage near his bedroom door. James had no idea how badly injured his father actually was. When James awoke at 5 a.m. the next morning, his father was still in the same place, now quite dead. James went for a doctor, but it was too late, and the doctor sent for the police. James was arrested for the willful murder of his father, Michael. At the post-mortem, Michael was found to have had 8 broken ribs and a ruptured blood vessel in his brain due to the violence. Now, it may have been caused by the blows or by the fall to the floor. The two men had consumed more than half a bottle of whiskey between them. James was said to have been quite fond of his father and was absolutely devastated at having caused his death. He was about 30 years old and had his own wife and 5 children. The charge was changed to manslaughter and the court proceedings began in March 1898. After hearing all of the evidence, James was found guilty and, with the recommendation of mercy, was sentenced to just 4 months' jail.
For a fascinating look at life in a colonial prison, visit Geelong Jail Museum. Situated just over an hour from Melbourne in the heart of Geelong, it's Victoria's most intact and longest continually operating colonial prison. For information, search for Geelong Jail or call 1300 865 800.
Now, our next couple of stories relate to young women and their infant children, but they were treated very, very differently. Our first story relates to Ellen Davey, a young 20-year-old woman who was a teacher at a well-known Sandhurst establishment which her widowed mother ran. Ellen was described as being of a slight figure and of simple, ladylike and self-possessed manners. Ellen had been feeling ill for quite some time, so ill that she consulted a doctor at least 3 times without any result. On hearing that a friend and her husband were heading to Sorrento for the Christmas period, Ellen asked if she could accompany them to try and regain some of her health, which was agreed to. On Christmas morning at breakfast at the Continental Hotel, other guests remarked how well Ellen looked and how the holiday seemed to have suited her. However, things were about to change. That morning, one of the yardmen of the hotel was clearing out the earth closet when he made an awful discovery. It was the deceased body of a female infant. This earth closet connected to one of the upstairs bathrooms. Police were called and Senior Constable Fergus, who was in charge of the quarantine police station at Portsea, arrived to investigate. He followed the trail of blood from the bathroom to the bedroom, which Ellen had stayed in the night before. On being questioned, Ellen did not deny the birth of the child, saying it had been a great surprise to her, as she did not know she'd even been pregnant. The child had shown no signs of life, so Ellen placed it in the earth closet. Ellen was arrested for child murder and was taken back to the police station, the quarantine station. However, Senior Constable Fergus felt it would be more humane if Ellen had been taken care of in the police residence instead, where she received every care and attention. At the post-mortem, the child was found to be only 5 or 6 months gestation and had never taken a breath. The charge was changed to one of concealment of birth. However, the Attorney General abandoned any prosecution against Ellen Davey and she was free to live her life. Now, our second story of infanticide at Christmas time was a very different one and takes place in a town called Toolamba near Maroopna in regional Victoria. The body of a female infant was found in a paddock near the house of a farmer named McSweeney on December 23, 1881. The infant was in a very bad state. The body had been covered with slabs of a tree and had met with a horrendous death. At inquest, it was stated that the baby girl had been stabbed 22 times in her back, chest and face. There were a number of contusions that looked as if somebody had jumped on her small body. Perhaps the worst thing was the tree branch that had been rammed down her throat, perhaps in an attempt to quieten the baby. The child's liver was lacerated and her stomach had burst. Suspicion immediately fell upon 16-year-old Sarah or Annie Gifford, who had been employed as a domestic servant at the farm until the day before the body was found. Sarah had been last seen working in the same paddock. It had also been noted that Sarah was pregnant. Sarah was arrested by Constable McGee at her sister's house and committed to trial for infanticide. It would come to light that Mrs. McSweeney had sent Sarah outside during the night, but that she was in good health when she returned and went to her room around 10 p.m. At about 11 o'clock, Sarah was heard to go outside yet again and returned after a short time. Then 2 hours later, she went again outside. Sarah was next seen by one of the farmhands who helped her to get water from the tank and take it to the house for her at around 6 o'clock in the morning. Shortly afterwards, the body of the little girl was discovered by William McSweeney. Now, Sarah complained of a headache and the following morning, saying that she had had too much sun the day before and needed to go to her sister's house, which she did. Sarah said that she tried to retrieve the body of the little girl to take with her to bury at her sister's house, but that she couldn't find it. Dr. True testified to Sarah being recently confined and that the child had been born alive. But he also warned that the agony of childbirth on somebody so young may have caused Sarah to inflict the injuries on the child. The jury returned in 15 minutes and found that Sarah was not guilty and she was acquitted.
Interested in learning more about this episode? Join the Locked Up With History Facebook group for more facts and discussions about the dark colonial past of Victoria and beyond.
There are many more stories we could have included today, but for the sake of making it not too long to listen to, we've chosen just a few stories. But there is one story I cannot finish without mentioning, and that is my favourite serial killer, Frederick Bailey Deeming. Now, Deeming fits into our Christmas murders as he murdered his second wife, Emily Mather, on Christmas Eve in 1891 and buried her beneath the hearth of the second bedroom of their rental house in Windsor. During the investigation, what would be discovered is that Deeming had also murdered his first wife, Mary, and their 4 children while he was courting Emily in England. It is a story of many twists and turns, which is why it will be its own podcast in 2022 and also one I've been asked to write a chapter for on in an upcoming book. Before we wrap up the stories of our Christmas murders, please don't forget to check out our webpage at lockedupwithhistory.com.au where all of the previous episodes are along with some photos for the episodes where we have them. Of course, you can also listen to all of the episodes on your favourite podcast streaming platform. And just a reminder that now on Spotify, you can also leave us a rating if you so desire. If you have any questions or would like to discuss any of the episodes, join us over on Facebook and the Locked Up With History group. This is where you can ask me any questions on the current episodes and where you can view any of the media associated with the episodes as well. If you have any suggestions on a story you might like to hear a podcast on, please feel free to send us a message in the group or to one of our emails and we will certainly consider it. As this is our final episode for 2021, I would like to take this opportunity to wish all of our listeners a very Merry Christmas and a happy and safe New Year. I hope that you get to spend some quality time with your family and friends and take time to refresh for 2022. I know that I will be, and hopefully we'll find some time to do some dedicated research. The Locked Up With History podcast will return in February next year with more stories of the Geelong Jail, historical true crimes and funky colonial history. Until then, see you on the darker side.
For more information on the story from today's episode, check out the show notes or join the Locked Up With History Facebook group. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.